Clinical Conversations IBD aims to provide healthcare professionals practical information on implementing evidence-based, guidelines-recommended care for patients. In this podcast, we'll hear from internist Dr. Daron Schneider, Chief Patient Safety and Quality Officer for Abingdon Health, and gastroenterologist Dr. Sununda Kane, Professor of Medicine at the Mayo Clinic.
So good morning. I'm here with Susie Kane, gastroenterologist from Mayo Clinic, and welcome again, Susie.
Well, good morning. Thank you. Welcome to you too.
Thank you very much. So we're talking about inflammatory bowel disease, and we're at the stage in this conversation where our patient has been referred to you, and you've worked them up and have made a diagnosis of inflammatory bowel disease. And again, for this conversation, it's Crohn's or ulcerative colitis. At that point, there's a need to select the right agent for that patient. And I think for the primary care community, this is going to be very helpful for us to understand not only how you select which medicine, but how we can really work best with you to make sure that patients are adherent to their medicines and that we can safely co-manage this patient together. So let's start perhaps with that very first selection, and how do you do it, right? So, from within the primary care world, we certainly know steroids. We know that there's immunomodulators that have just exploded on the scene in the last decade, and some of this is relatively new to us. So walk us through that process. How do you approach the newly diagnosed patient with IBD?
Right. So I appreciate the opportunity, and I can give an hour lecture just on this topic alone. So I'll keep it at a really high level, not to confuse anybody, but just sort of give you the 10,000 foot approach to this. So we'll keep the conversation at this point just limited to Crohn's disease, because ulcerative colitis really is a different diagnosis. There are certainly medications that overlap and can be used for either diagnosis, but I think that the nuancing is much more prevalent for Crohn's disease. So the first thing that we do is we assess the location of the disease, because that's going to drive the need for certain therapies over others. And why do I say that? If it involves two different organs, so the colon and the small intestine, that's a patient who is at greater risk for complications like fistula formation or stricturing. And so we want to be more aggressive. The patient who has it in just one organ, meaning just the colon or just the small intestine, that you might have a little bit more wiggle room. So you need to decide what the location is. If they have upper Crohn's disease, so in the esophagus or the stomach or the duodenum, then actually you're going to trigger that location differently than the more distal GI tract. And actually, acid suppression is usually how we treat the upper Crohn's disease. So once you know your location, then you have to decide, are they mild, moderate, or severe? And we have standard criteria for those definitions. But basically, in a clinician's, from a clinician standpoint, mild means that there's not any significant anemia, that they have symptoms that are not life altering per se, that they can still work full time, that their bowel habit is manageable without antidiarrheals, that they are not losing weight, and that they are not at risk for deep penetrating ulcers and complications. The moderate patient is a patient who may be cutting back on their activities of daily living. They're losing productivity at work because they're missing days because of their symptoms, and that you're already thinking, oh, gosh, goodness, this person's fairly sick and they need help. And then the severe Crohn's disease patient is the one that we historically think about and see in the textbooks, who are emaciated, who may already have a fistula, either around their perianal region or even enterocutaneous, that they are clearly malnourished, they may be febrile, they have extra intestinal manifestations, and are people who are usually on either supplemental feeds or are in the hospital, who may be headed for the operating room. So if
so
you keep this,
so let me stop
them,
you there. That,
yeah,
that,
I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's very helpful. So really, you want to look at the disease activity. You want to look at symptoms. You know, make your decision making germane or about those. My understanding also is that we're moving, you know, to also thinking about really suppressing the inflammatory response. So help us understand too, in the context of you've got the patient who's presenting with symptoms, are you looking at inflammatory markers to help guide your thinking early on? Somebody with milder symptoms but very, very high inflammatory markers. Do you think about them differently, or are we still pretty much focused mostly on the symptoms and how aggressive
That's a really good question, because we do need some sort of objective criteria by which to monitor the patient for response or worsening. And so absolutely a CRP can be very helpful that at the outset of your initiation of whatever therapy you're going to choose, a CRP at baseline is a nice objective marker that you can follow over time. You don't do it too frequently, but if it's an outpatient, every month or so, making sure that the CRP is dropping, because you want that to control that inflammation. That is a very good point. Yes.
Yeah, and I wonder if it's somewhat analogous for us in the primary care world to think about treating a target as it relates to diabetes, for example. So with our diabetic patients, no matter how they are feeling, we want to get their A1C down. Some would say down to 8, some would say down to 7. There's argument about the right endpoint, but we know that there's a marker, right? So is this somewhat analogous at this point, for given the range of symptom presentations, are you treating, and we'll get to which agents here in a second, but are you treating towards trying to get to a particular target inflammatory level?
Yeah, so that's a really good point, and I like that analogy. I hadn't heard that one before. So yes, I would say that CRP could be analogous to that hemoglobin A1C, that you want it to be normal. Having said that, there are a couple of other markers that you can follow. So the hemoglobin, is it stabilizing? Is it increasing? Meaning that you are stemming the loss of blood and allowing, the body to then, remake red blood cells and actually keep them in circulation. And then albumin. Is your albumin going up, meaning that you are actually absorbing the calories and the protein that you're ingesting and not losing them? So I think that there are a few different markers that are objective that you could follow and feel pretty confident that you're on the right track.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if that helps you at all with really looking at adherence as well for some of the regimens that we're about to talk about. You probably have some expectation of some reduction in inflammatory markers with some of the meds that patients are taking, and if they're not taking it, you may see that there's lack of movement in inflammatory markers. I know we do that within the diabetes world or the blood pressure world, things that we treat in a primary care space. Is that analogy extend to these agents as well to a certain extent?
Well, and then that's interesting that you say that, because as we talk about immunomodulators, which historically have been the only class of therapy that we had prior to the introduction of biologics. So if we talk about immunomodulators, these are agents that work on the DNA of the white blood cells, and that's how they impart their anti-inflammatory mechanism, and so you are suppressing the immune system in that way. And an immunomodulator will cause a reduction in the white blood cell count, and it will also cause a macrocytosis. So you can actually use a CBC for tracking adherence, because you would expect the white blood cell count to hover around 4 or 5 and cause a relative leukopenia. and you would expect an elevated MCV, and you would expect on the differential a decreased lymphocyte count. And if those are all present, then you know that the patient is taking their immunomodulator, i.e. a thiopurine, because those are the known effects and expected effects on the bone marrow of that agent. So it's actually a nice trick.
Right. So with no further ado, now that we understand the analogy somewhat to conditions that we treat, in the primary care world, help us then understand the different classes. You already, spoke just a moment ago about immunomodulators and, really the role of monitoring. So what are the different classes and what do we really need to know about them in co-managing these patients with you?
So I would say that I would break it down into three different categories for therapies. Or actually, there's probably four. So the first category is what we call the topical topical therapies, which mean those therapies that only treat the mucosa, that the medication imparts an effect only at the local level of the mucosa and not the immune system. And so that would include all of the mesalamine products. And so so when you have inflammation in your colon, you don't necessarily need to, if it's mild enough, you don't necessarily need to suppress the immune system. You can use a local affecting therapy like a mesalamine to treat that. And then there are topical steroids and in particular budesonide. So budesonide imparts its steroid effect topically, not systemically, and can be very effective in the short term for treating Crohn's. Then we move into the steroid category, with the systemic steroids. So prednisone, prednisolone, and those are quick-acting, basically shut down the entire immune system, and will be very effective to treat active inflammatory Crohn's disease. They are cheap. They are simple to prescribe. You don't need a prior authorization or any other paperwork, and you can get them from the local pharmacy. So I do see that the partnership with the internist is important, because if I'm not available as the gastroenterologist to the patient, to our mutual patient who may be having a flare, and then they call you, and that it's not unreasonable for you to say, well, gosh, you sound really sick, let's get you, better right now, and that you prescribe prednisone. But the understanding and the contract there is that, okay, I'm giving you a limited amount, and that we need to just treat the active symptoms right now, but this is not a long-term therapy. The toxicity of steroids far outweigh the benefits long-term, and so we always have an anticipated exit strategy once we put that patient on steroids. So that should be the mindset for the internist as well. That's terrific that you're available and able to take care of those patients' symptoms right then, because they need to get to work and feel better, but that it's not a long-term treatment or solution. So we do have to worry about if a patient is on, even after just a week, they're going to become adrenally suppressed. They are going to have issues with glucose control, with acute psychosis, with AVN, and then longer term with hypertension, with cataracts, with glaucoma, and osteoporosis. So just a systemic effect is great for the inflammation, but then also systemic toxicity. The immunomodulators we touched upon, so the thiopurines, which are oral therapies, which makes them super convenient. They are also inexpensive because they've been around since the 1950s, and are effective. But the problems with immunomodulators is that it takes 3 to 4 months for them to kick in, because they have to impart their mechanism of effect on the bone marrow. And so you've got some short-term toxicity that needs to be screened for, and sometimes that patient isn't going to call the gastroenterologist, they're going to call their internist. And so fevers, arthralgias, and pancreatitis, if they develop that, you know, abdominal pain, nausea, vomiting, they may be calling their internist rather than the gastroenterologist. And so hopefully there's been a conversation between the internist and the gastroenterologist to say, hey, I'm putting this patient on an immunomodulator. If they call you with these three things, you know, have them stop it immediately because these are all reversible side effects. And then the other immunomodulator in that class is methotrexate. Methotrexate can be a pill or it can be a shot. And so so it can be confusing if the patient calls you and says, well, I'm taking these shots and they're not working, or I'm having some sort of reaction. And if they're not savvy to know that it's not an injectable biologic and it's just methotrexate, there can be some confusion there in the kind of conversation you need to have. So I circle back again that hopefully the gastroenterologist is doing their due diligence and having that communication and conversation with you so that you can anticipate what it is that that patient may complain of and what we should do about it if they call. Is this clear as mud, right?
It's extremely important, extremely helpful. I think that really what you've walked through so far is the topicals, the steroid class, the immunomodulators. Each one of them has its own immediate and acute toxicities, longer term, you know, impact on chronic health. I would simply offer that having clarity of communication in the consults that are coming back and forth is an opportunity for all that are listening to consider, can we do better, right? So simply, you know, putting a patient on a med without having clarity about the indication, the expected side effects, when to prompt a call to the GI doctor versus a PCP, all of that can really be part of the best kind of consult that would come from the GI doc to the primary doc. And alluding to that, you know, and bringing that forward to the patient as well to make it exquisitely clear, you know, that these are the triggers, these are the red flags that should prompt a call to your doctors. I think I just wanted to highlight that because each one of these drugs is powerful, each one with its own set of issues, and the better that we can partner with patients and really build a medical community around that patient is our opportunity.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. Did you want to move into the into the next class, the bigger guns that are now available on the market
right,
in the in the biologic space, right? So
exactly.
So tell us a little bit about them. What do we need to know?
Sure. So so of course biologics are advertised on television now. So I will use brand names and mention Humira, which is an injectable, Entyvio, which is IV, and now Stelara, which is an IV dose for as a one-time sort of induction therapy, and then it's injectable after that. So let's talk about so in the late 1990s, the only biologic and the first biologic class that came out are called anti-TNF agents. So TNF, or tumor necrosis factor, is a very potent pro-inflammatory cytokine, and it was first discovered to be a protein that was produced by tumors, and so that's how it got its name. But having said that, the body, without having a tumor in it, produces this marker. So it's somewhat of an unfortunate nomenclature issue because patients will get very nervous and they're like, I have a tumor? You didn't tell me I had cancer. But tumor necrosis factor is a factor that we make on our own. It was just initially described in those rats and then people who had tumors, and the tumors were making this protein. So having said that, these are agents that are that are meant to block the activity of tumor necrosis factor, which is a very, again, a very potent pro-inflammatory agent and revs up the inflammatory environment. And because that's so nonspecific, that's why the anti-TNF agents, whether they are IV or whether they are injectable, treat a whole host of conditions. So rheumatoid arthritis, psoriasis, psoriatic arthritis, ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, ankylosing spondylitis. So a lot of itises because of its very nonspecific nature, and it makes a very nice target as an inflammatory agent to go after. So we had back in the late 90s the anti-TNF agents, very well studied because they've been around for such a long time, and very effective. The things that I think an internist needs to know about anti-TNF agents is that, one, that they do treat a myriad of different inflammatory conditions that range both GI and rheumatologic and now dermatologic worlds, that really the side effect profile comes from the fact that these are biologics, quote unquote, meaning that they are proteins and not chemicals. And so anytime you introduce a protein into the body, that recipient or that patient can develop antibodies to that protein and have immune reactions or allergic reactions, or else build what we call neutralizing antibodies, so that it basically makes the therapy inactive and no longer efficacious. So immune phenomenon and then infection. So if we are suppressing a major part of the immune system in order to get it to shut off to see the effect that we want, you're going to be at risk for infection. And there are certain infections that that are more prevalent. And so that is TB and reactivation of hepatitis B, and then certain viruses and funguses. So not so much the bacterial infections, but the viruses, the fungus, and the TB. So that's why it's so important for there to be updated vaccinations before we start these agents, as well as annual flu shots. And now that we've got a non-live, non-attenuated shingles vaccine, that's just really been a game changer in terms of getting our patients vaccinated for the preventable infectious diseases. I'm going to stop a minute, catch my breath, and let you ask me.
Yeah, no, how wonderful. So it sounds like the biologics, there's multiple classes. You walked us through the history, you know, back in the late 90s with the TNF agents. You know, those are the infliximabs, the adalimumabs, et cetera. Clearly, you know, they do modulate the immune system, so you're going to have risk for infection, TB, hepatitis. You know, this is critical for us at the primary care level to know that and to make sure that with patients who are presenting with fever that are on these agents, we take them extremely seriously. With just stopping there, are the other classes of immunomodulators, are they any different just as it relates to those immune effects for suppression of the immune status? Can we lump them all together in a broad brush for the primary care, you know, community, or are they in some way different as it relates to their likelihood to lead to infection and other side effects?
Right. So I think in a broad stroke, yes, that you're really worried more. So the immunomodulators, you're worried more about viruses and fungus. So those things that are not necessarily bacterial driven, where antibiotics are needed. And so the important teaching lesson there is that, you know, bronchitis, the upper respiratory, that when a patient presents with upper respiratory symptoms, that more likely, if they are on an immunomodulator or biologic, it's going to be viral induced and not bacterial. And so you really want to be prudent with giving these Crohn's patients antibiotics, because they would be more at risk for C. difficile at that point, and just the GI effects of antibiotics in and of themselves can lead to just worse symptomatology. But I will say that, you know, as we talk about the other two classes now of biologics, so Entyvio, which is it's an alpha anti-integrin, so it works differently than an anti-TNF, that puts you more at risk for certain kinds of viruses, and that includes, that's why the patients hear on the TV commercial certain brain infections, so that's PML, or progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy caused by the JC virus. And it's because what you are doing is you are disrupting the attachment of the white blood cell to the mucosal layer. And when you do that, you are disrupting other pathways that would set up this virus to get through into a place where it's otherwise been protected against. And that particularly in the multiple sclerosis patients who get this biologic to treat their neurologic disease, it's a similar mechanism of action for Crohn's, and that in theory there is risk for this brain infection. We have not seen it in the use of Entyvio, but its cousin compound, Tysabri, it is a known potential side effect. So, you know, from a medical legal standpoint, the company has to say, well, this agent works like Tysabri, and so there is this theoretical risk. So that discussion is held with a gastroenterologist, and for reasons that are evident, if you're not able to explain this properly, the patients don't want that therapy. However, if they are on Entyvio, that the two things that we ask our primary care physicians to watch out for actually are elevated liver enzymes and any kind of new neurologic symptoms that may develop. And that would be a trigger to do a workup to look for this possible mechanism.
So let me just break that down for us. What you said is that for immunomodulators, patients are more at risk for viruses, so don't treat with antibiotics for bronchitis, for example. So that's a very nice pearl, right? Anti-TNF agents and anti-integrin agents, patients are at risk for reactivation of TB. So annual TB testing would be of value. And then for the anti-integrin, really focusing on neurologic symptoms as early signs and early manifestations of PML is really important. And then liver function testing. So I'm assuming that there is periodic monitoring that is going to need to be really discussed amongst the primary and the GI doc as to who's doing what. Can you give us a sense of, is that quarterly? Is that every 6 months? What is the blood work when you're on either an anti-TNF or an anti-integrin agent that we should be making sure the patients get?
Right. And so we had discussed briefly, the utility of a CBC and a SED rate. So when you feel comfortable that the patient's symptoms and disease are under better control, then we are talking about monitoring their blood work. I think it's just, for simplicity's sake, we just recommend that for any agent that they are on, that every 3 months they get a CBC and they get a comprehensive metabolic panel, because that's going to show us their electrolytes, and it's going to show us their liver enzymes and their albumin level.
Great.
So every 3 months.
All right. So did we cover it? Any final
words? One more class.
Yeah.
So the newest class of the biologics. So, you know, in my career, I have seen us go from no biologics to now we have three classes of biologics. So the newest one on the block, which is advertised So I do think it's worthy of discussion because,
sure,
you know, we watch television once in a while ourselves, so we need to understand what's out there. So is Stelara, which is ustekinumab, which is yet another mechanism of action, and it blocks interleukins now, as opposed to TNF or working at the level of the mucosal lining. So again, another blockade of pro-inflammatory cytokines, but different than TNF. And so it's a little bit more targeted. And Stelara is FDA approved for psoriasis as well now as for Crohn's disease. It's injectable, and that it does appear to have a little bit of a safer side effect profile than the anti-TNFs, only because it is less global, if you will. But we still recommend that there's vaccinations done before and then annually for influenza, and that there is monitoring of the CBC and liver enzymes every 3 months. I forgot to mention that Entyvio, the compelling argument to use Entyvio is that it is GI specific. So I mentioned that the anti-TNF agents are very broad in their spectrum, and Stelara is used for psoriasis and Crohn's. Interestingly, Entyvio only works at the level of the GI tract because it's the anti-integrin layer, so it's the barrier function of the GI tract where this is targeted, so it only works on the GI tract. So you can't get it to use for psoriasis or rheumatoid arthritis. It doesn't work. It only works on the GI tract.
So what a whirlwind. In the last 20 minutes, we were able to go over multiple classes. There's topicals, there's steroids, there's immunomodulators. Now there's three different classes of biologics. Can you say, just in wrapping up, you know, the importance of us aggressively treating this disease? And, you know, I do understand there's emerging data that suggests that, you know, the more that we use steroids early on and don't get people transitioned to some of these agents, that their risk goes up for future strictures, fistula, surgery, and other bad stuff to happen. So really making sure that the GI doc is as aggressive as necessary and that the primary doc is, you know, ensuring follow-up with the GI doc, it is increasingly important for us to get patients on these on the right agent, given the data that's emerging about the overall impact and the quality of life and the complications. Can you maybe in just 30 seconds or a minute just summarize that for us as we end this section?
Right. Yeah, so I thank you so much for bringing that up, that it is so important for the partnership to be there, because the messaging has to be the same, that as the primary care physician, that you guys understand the importance of early and aggressive treatment when appropriate, because the patient doesn't understand that if they don't do this, that 3 years from now, they're going to have a stricture and they're going to need an operation. And that, you know, as a gastroenterologist, I can say this, but they have an established relationship with you. And if you can say, hey, you know what, Dr. Kane has prescribed this, and I agree with that, because, you know, and emphasizing and messaging the same points is so key.
Thank you so much. What a great overview of the landscape of options that we have for our patients with IBD, and for us this morning, a particular focus on the Crohn's patients. So we'll leave it there. And again, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It's been great. Take care.
This has been Clinical Conversations IBD. This podcast was developed for the American Gastroenterological Association by Knighton Health and was supported by a medical education grant from Takeda Pharmaceuticals.